Welcome to the e-learning guide for the Cover Pro Bono Lawyers. The overall objective of the e-learning guide is to lay emphasis on the legal aspects as contained in the Cover Pro Bono Lawyers Training Guide on Sexual and Gender-Based Violence, commonly known as SGBV. The guide aims to equip lawyers with the necessary tools and knowledge to assist the elderly and women and girls with intellectual disabilities. Let us begin. Malkia is married to Fadhili, and together they have three beautiful children, aged 8, 10, and 12 years old. In the last 20 years, Malkia stayed home to take care of the children and support her husband's business interests. Due to Malkia's family connections and support, Fadhili became one of the leading businessmen in the country. The couple amassed much wealth with vast business interests in real estate and the oil and gas industry. The couple's net assets are valued close to 10 million Kenyan shillings. Over the years, Malkia let her husband control the business and the finances while she hosted networking functions for the husband and business associates. Despite the glossy family picture, Malkia has endured years of suffering behind closed doors. On numerous occasions, Fadhili punched and hurled insults at Malkia in the presence of their children. One of the couple's children, Riziki, the firstborn, developed cognitive challenges a few years after birth. In July last year, after a drunken episode, Fadhili arrived home to find Malkia asleep and demanded to have sex. Malkia declined, and Fadhili could hear none of it. Despite her struggles, he forced himself on her. Malkia sought the intervention of her in-laws and her parents, but they told her to focus on the future due to Fadhili's political aspirations. Upon learning that Malkia spoke to their parents about their marital issues, Fadhili blocked Malkia's credit cards, leaving her destitute. Being the only girl, Riziki sleeps in her room, and Malkia has witnessed Fadhili leaving the room only in his towel. For the last few months, Malkia has begged money from Fadhili, who only gives money when he feels like it. In the 2 months, Fadhili has hosted parties in the couple's matrimonial home, at one point placing Riziki at risk of sexual violence. Upon asking Fadhili to stop with the parties, Malkia endured a night of punching and kicking. Recently, Riziki confided in her mother that Baba did bad manners to her. Malkia is now staying at a friend's house and she has no money to support the children, and Fadhili keeps sending her threatening messages. This is a reality that thousands of women and girls endure. The situation is even worse for women and girls living with intellectual disabilities. I ask that you keep this reality in mind as we explore ways in which a cover pro bono lawyer can use the power of law as a tool for change. The first topic of discussion is a reporting and referral mechanism. We begin by examining the role of a lawyer in the reporting and referral mechanism on SGBV. According to the Manual on Mental Disorders, an intellectually challenged person is a person with limitations in intellectual reasoning. Section 4 of the Victim Protection Act requires the provision of legal and social services to a victim of crime, including SGBV victims. What then is the role of the lawyer in the reporting stage? The lawyer must interview the client, and in the case of an intellectually challenged woman or girl, they must conduct the interview in the presence of the caregiver. The lawyer must ensure they collect all relevant information and documentation from the client, including the occurrence book number, identity card or birth certificate. The lawyer should remember to obtain copies of the charge sheet, witness statements, and medical reports. The lawyer should take charge of the case and ensure that the client is afforded all the necessary support, including establishing the position of the case from the police, ensuring there's no delay in the investigations, ensuring the arrest of the perpetrator, and subsequent arraignment of the accused person in a court of law. The lawyer has to ensure that all the relevant stakeholders, including the police, understand the relevant provisions of the law against persons with disabilities, including the elements of the offense and special criminal procedures applicable to these offenses. The Victim Protection Act recognizes the need for different agencies to work together to provide a victim with all the necessary services. Section 2 of the law defines those services to include all the services offered to the victims of crime to secure restoration of their emotional, mental, physical, legal, or economic status from any harm occasioned by the offense committed. For a lawyer to adequately support a survivor of SGBV, the lawyer should ensure that the victim receives prompt and quality services from all the relevant stakeholders from the start to the closure of the case. The lawyer must ensure that the client is accorded the necessary protection measures, such as placement in shelter or a place of safety if necessary. As a lawyer undertakes to support a survivor or a client dealing with SGBV, it is important to develop a sound understanding of the Kenyan legal framework. Therefore, our second topic of discussion is the Kenyan legal framework. The government of Kenya has taken several legislative and policy steps that indicate a commitment to advancing the rights of persons with disabilities. Kenya has signed and ratified international and regional treaties that provide unique protection to such persons. Further, the government has enacted a national legal framework that accords special protection to persons with disabilities. The treaties ratified by Kenya protect persons with disabilities through the rights to fair treatment, appropriate care, inclusion, and full participation in society. How does the international and regional legal framework look like? Article 2, Subarticle 5, and Subarticle 6 of the Constitution gives the basis for international law in Kenya. Kenya has signed and ratified several human rights instruments to protect the rights of women and girls living with intellectual disabilities. The major instruments include the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. The UNCRPD gives the basis for rights for persons with disabilities, and Article 12 provides for the determination of the legal capacity of persons with intellectual disabilities. CEDAW is often described as an international bill of rights for women. The treaty requires states to protect women, including women with disabilities, from all forms of violence. CEDAW General Recommendation 19 and 35 on violence against women requires states to end customs allowing violence against women and to eliminate roles that perpetuate widespread violent practices. These practices include family violence, forced marriage, dowry deaths, acid attacks, and female circumcision. At the regional level, Kenya has signed and ratified the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. The charter requires states which have ratified the treaty to ensure equal protection of the law to all persons and to respect for personal integrity and human dignity. The Protocol to the African Charter on the Rights of Women in Africa, popularly known as the Maputo Protocol, is a binding legal framework that holds African governments to account for the violation of the rights of women and girls in Africa, including women and girls with disabilities. Kenya is yet to sign or ratify the Protocol to the African Charter on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that provides for the special protection of persons with disabilities, including intellectual disabilities. Kenya has enacted a robust national legal framework to protect women and girls. Let us now examine some of the laws. To start with, under Article 27 of the Constitution, the law prohibits discrimination based on disability and provides for the equality and non-discrimination of all persons under the law. The Constitution also guarantees the right to access to justice for all persons and guarantees that if any fee is required, then the same should be reasonable and shall not impede access to justice. Article 53 requires the promotion of the best interests of the child, while Article 54 requires that persons with disabilities, including intellectually challenged women and girls, to be treated with dignity and respect, and to be addressed and referred to in a manner that is not demeaning. The Persons with Disability Act, CAP 133, the Laws of Kenya, recognizes the rights of persons with disabilities, including the right to be free from all forms of violence. The Protection Against Domestic Violence Act, No. 2 of 2015, provides for the protection and relief to domestic violence victims, including persons with disabilities, such as intellectually challenged women and girls, or the elderly. Under this law, domestic violence includes child marriage, female genital mutilation, forced marriage, forced wife inheritance, interference from in-laws, sexual abuse within a marriage, virginity testing, and widow cleansing. The Sexual Offences Act, No. 3 of 2006, extends protection to persons with disabilities to include a caregiver or a person reporting on their behalf. The law, under Section 31, provides for vulnerable witnesses such as intellectually challenged women and girls and the elderly. The section also provides for the role of an intermediary in assisting them during the court hearing. The law also recognizes that children and persons with intellectual challenges cannot give consent. The Penal Code, CAP 63, Laws of Kenya, prohibits simple assault as well as an assault which results in bodily harm. The enactment of the Sexual Offences Act repealed most sections relating to sexual violence. It is important to note that Section 146 provides for the offence of rape of persons with intellectual challenges. The section is, however, derogatory and refers to persons with intellectual challenges as idiots and imbeciles. The Prohibition of Female Genital Mutilation Act, No. 32 of 2011, prohibits the practice of female genital mutilation and safeguards against violation of a person's mental or physical integrity through the practice of female genital mutilation. The Victim Protection Act, No. 17 of 2014, provides for the rights of victims of crime, including SGBV victims, during the pre-trial, the trial, and the post-trial phase. The Children's Act, CAP 141, Laws of Kenya, sets out the rights of children and prohibits discrimination on the grounds of disability and provides for the procedure of safeguarding children. It is important to remember the best interests of the child are paramount in all matters concerning them. The Witness Protection Act, CAP 79, Laws of Kenya, provides for the protection of witnesses in criminal cases and other proceedings. Through the Director of Public Prosecutions and the National Police Service, an SGBV survivor or witness can apply for protection to the agency. The Criminal Procedure Code, CAP 75, Laws of Kenya, and the Evidence Act, CAP 80, Laws of Kenya, provide for the criminal procedures and the rules of submitting evidence in a court of law. What are some of the specific definitions of sexual and gender-based violence offences? Section 2 to Section 24 of the Sexual Offences Act provides for the definitions of rape, attempted rape, defilement, attempted defilement, child sex tourism, sexual assault, indecent act, and other sexual offences and penalties. Section 2 of the Victim Protection Act provides for the definition of the victim. Section 2 of the Protection Against Domestic Violence Act provides for the definition of domestic violence, while Section 4 provides for the definition of a domestic relationship. Section 2 of the Prohibition Against Female Genital Mutilation provides for the definition of female genital mutilation. Further, Section 2 and Section 3 of the Counter-Trafficking in Persons Act provides for the definition of trafficking in persons. As a lawyer represents victims of SGBV, and especially girls and women with intellectual challenges, the elements of identification and consent sometimes becomes a challenge. So how do you prove identification in a court of law? You can prove identification in 5 recognized ways. First, through eyewitness identification. In criminal law, it is the evidence received from a witness who has actually seen an event and can so testify in court, meaning it is the direct evidence of a witness who saw the perpetrator in the act. Second, you can prove identification through a single witness. Section 124 of the Evidence Act provides that in a criminal case, if the only evidence is that of the victim, the court proceeds to hear that evidence and can use it to convict the accused person. Third, you can prove identification through identification parade. The Kenya Police Service Standing Orders, Chapter 42, Section 7, guides identification of witnesses where the identity is in dispute. In the case of women and girls with intellectual disabilities, identification parades may conclusively prove the identification of the perpetrator. You can also prove identification through forensic evidence. Section 36 of the Sexual Offences Act provides that the court may direct for collection of appropriate accused person sample or samples for forensic and other scientific testing, including a DNA test. Lastly, on identification versus recognition, for vulnerable witnesses such as women and girls with intellectual disabilities and the elderly, the prosecution can use the 5 senses to prove identification. Section 63, subsection 2C of the Evidence Act refers to a fact which could be perceived by any other sense or in any other manner, the evidence of a witness who says he perceived it by that sense or in that manner, such as touch, smell, taste, hearing, or sight. Then, how do you prove consent? According to Black's Law Dictionary, consent is a concurrence of informed and freely given will, which is not obtained by coercion or undue influence. Section 43, subsection 4E of the Sexual Offences Act provides that children and persons of unsound mind as incapable of giving consent. Please note that consent is phrase. It is freely given, reversible, informed, enthusiastic, and specific. Our third topic of discussion is a victim-centered approach. To ensure all-round support for survivors of SDBV, a trial lawyer should promote a victim-centered approach in the trial process. So, how do you go about it? Section 2 of the Victim Protection Act defines a victim as any natural person who suffers injury, loss, or damage as a consequence of an offense. A complainant is defined in Section 2 of the Criminal Procedure Code as amended by the Criminal Law Amendment Act No. 5 of 2003 as a person who lodges a complaint with the police or any lawful authority. Section 2 of the Sexual Offences Act also holds the same definition for a complainant. A vulnerable victim, as defined by Section 2 of the Victim Protection Act, refers to a victim who, due to age, gender, disability, or other special characteristics, requires the provision of special justice and support under the law. This includes women and girls with intellectual disabilities and the elderly. Section 31 of the Sexual Offences Act and Sections 4, 17, and 18 of the Victim Protection Act advance a victim-centered approach, especially for SDBV victims. Under Section 17 of the Victim Protection Act and Section 31 of the Sexual Offences Act, the court can make a declaration that a witness or a victim is a vulnerable witness within the meaning of the law, and the court can direct the necessary protection, such as the assistance of an intermediary, be offered to the victim. Under the auspices of the Constitution and the Victim Protection Act, lawyers have moved from just watching brief to being active participants within the trial. Section 9 of the Victim Protection Act gives victims numerous rights within the trial process, including the right to legal representation and to adduce evidence left out by the prosecution. Article 50, Subarticle 7 of the Constitution, Section 4, Section 9 of the Victim Protection Act supports the victim and counsels application for participation in criminal cases. The position was reiterated in the case of Mary Kinga Rukwaru versus Raghunathan Santosh and another, and in the case of Gideon Mwiti Irea versus the Director of Public Prosecutions and seven others. It is essential to note the following. Article 50, Subarticle 7 of the Constitution, Section 4, and Section 9 of the Victim Protection Act supports the victim counsel's application for participation in criminal cases. Due to the novelty of the Victim Protection Act, a victim counsel may face opposition from other parties. To advance victim rights during the trial, a lawyer should ensure that they make an application for participation in the trial using the provisions cited. If the trial court issues unfavorable orders against the victim counsel's participation, the lawyer must remember they have recourse to the High Court under Section 362 to Section 364 of the Criminal Procedure Code. Under Section 26 of the Victim Protection Act, victims have a right to compensation or restitution from the offender. The lawyer can make such an application after the conviction of the accused person. Lawyers should encourage victims to file impact statements under Section 12 of the Victim Protection Act. Subject to the trial court's guidance, a victim counsel can adduce evidence left out during the trial through cross-examination of defense and prosecution witnesses. The best practice in cross-examination is for the lawyer to ask questions that the prosecution has not touched on. On the victim's right of appeal, Section 362 of the Criminal Procedure Code provides the basis upon which a victim counsel can apply to the High Court for a review or revision upon issuing of an unfavorable order or ruling from a lower court. While victims do not have the express right of appeal, the court in Veronica Gitahi v. Republic held that a victim counsel can participate in an appeal subject to the court's directions. Our final topic of discussion is client care. Survivors of SGBV endure a lot of painful memories that cause trauma, and it is important for lawyers to understand ways in which they can assist them through client care. The American Psychological Association defines trauma as the emotional responses towards an extremely adverse event. The severity of the trauma can cause interference with an individual's ability to live a healthy life. Lawyers should make the following considerations when dealing with SGBV victims. A lawyer should always practice sensitivity to the client's needs. The lawyer should ensure that SGBV cases, particularly against intellectually challenged women and girls, are heard in camera to protect the privacy of the victims. The lawyer should ensure that victims continue to seek appropriate support services, such as counseling, throughout the trial. The lawyer should also seek the consent of the survivor and cover before addressing the media. If the client is unable to testify, the lawyer should adopt a trauma-focused approach, such as proposing adjourning the case to ensure the client is in good shape before testimony. The Victim Protection Act has certain provisions that recognize and protect the well-being of victims. Section 2 of the Victim Protection Act defines trauma as including physical injury, psychological or emotional distress. Section 8(1) provides that a victim has a right to privacy from the media and confidentiality as to information shared by service providers. Section 11 provides that any person dealing with the victim shall ensure that the victim is immediately secured from further harm before any other action is taken in relation to them. Subsection 2(c) provides that such services include immediate psychosocial support for the victim. Further, Section 14, subsection 2(a) provides that a victim shall be accorded support and welfare services to deal with physical injury and emotional trauma. In conclusion, lawyers should develop a sound understanding of their role in supporting SGBV victims who have intellectual challenges. A lawyer should also have a sound understanding of the substantive and procedural laws. It is important to remember to work closely and consult with other sector professionals such as counselors, children officers, and investigators in assisting survivors of SGBV, especially the elderly and women and girls with intellectual disabilities.